This is Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO news production in collaboration with WHYY and WNYC. I'm Nancy Solomon. We'll be speaking with the governor tonight about his moves to the national stage, getting rid of mask mandates, and how to lower your health care bill. Listeners, this is your chance to speak directly with the governor. Call us with your questions. The number is 973-297-0941. We'll also be taking your questions via social media using the hashtag AskGovMurphy. And the number again is 973-297-0941. We're joined now in the studios of WBGO in Newark by Governor Phil Murphy. Welcome back.
Nice to be back, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
So before we turn to all things New Jersey, let's talk about the situation in Ukraine. You served as ambassador to Germany, and I'm curious about your take on it because there's been some criticism of Germany that it hasn't come out strongly enough against Putin, either, you know, in terms of diplomacy or sanctions. What do you think needs to happen in this situation? Both what would you like to see Germany do, but also what the Biden administration should be doing?
On the German piece, I actually was quite encouraged by Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who's a guy I've known a long time, and his statements about Nord Stream 2, which is a massive gas pipeline from Russia to Germany, that was no longer viable or whatever the words he used. That's a powerful statement. Because that will hurt the German economy. President Biden said this yesterday. Sometimes in these things, you have to be willing to hurt yourself. And I think there's a lot of skepticism that Germany would actually step up with that sort of force. So as painful as it is, I was happy to see that. Right now, I'd say more parochially, I will bring this back to all things Jersey. We're looking at this through the lens of heightened, highest level of cyber defense, concern about energy prices, clearly concerned about men and women from Jersey who are in our armed forces who are not fighting in Ukraine. The president has said that's not going to happen, but there's a lot of deployment in NATO countries. I spoke to Ukrainian Orthodox Church, has its North American headquarters in South Bombrick, New Jersey. I spoke to Archbishop Zelensky today, so there's a Ukrainian community here that we care deeply about. In the bigger sense, Putin's a thug. He is the corrupt leader of a kleptocracy. It's not the Russians, it's him and his regime. And these guys, he's a bad, bad guy. And I applaud the Biden administration and maybe more broadly the alliance that is Putin has somehow managed to bring everybody closer together than they were within NATO. And I think you're going to see that these sanctions are only going to ratchet up. And he has no right doing what he's doing. And, Nancy, it is appalling and embarrassing that a former president in Donald Trump, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are laudatory and complimentary toward Vladimir Putin, who's a complete thug, who's our enemy, who's acting against our interests, who's claiming territory he has no right to claim. So this is dangerous as heck. I like the way we're playing our hand, but this is a very hard hand to play.
Yeah, we're already seeing. The Wall Street has become unstable, more unstable than it already was.
Yeah.
And gas prices, I think everyone's concerned about.
No question about it.
And that could start to, filter to the level of state politics in terms of the pressures that'll place on you.
And you've got 40 million innocent Ukrainians, and they've got a lot of relatives and around the world, including in Jersey. But in terms of our own remit and our own leadership, it does add volatility.
Yeah.
You know, when you trade stocks on Wall Street, they say volatility is your friend. I can guarantee you when you're running a government, it's not.
Yeah.
And this is going to add to that without question.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on. I would like to listen to a little bit of the tape from your inauguration speech last month as kind of a setup to the next conversation. So let's hear that.
We have moved forward. Where Washington has too often done too little, we have worked together to achieve so much. Where some in Washington pander to the powerful and the wealthiest, we are lifting up working families and strengthening the middle class while ensuring those at the top do and pay their fair share.
That was me.
Yeah. You are sounding a lot like a guy who wants to run for president.
That is not the case. Let me say that up front. Seriously, that is not the case. But I'll tell you what that was. It was born out of not patting ourselves on the back, spiking the ball in the end zone, but genuinely proud of how we've worked with the legislature and we've gotten a lot done. And then, sadly, looking at Washington and a lot of the stuff that we've been able to do up here, for whatever reason, has not been able to get done in Washington. And it was making the clear statement, you know what? If you want to look at what our country can look like, again, I'm not saying this with our chest puffed out. We've still got our challenges, believe me. That stronger, fairer, forward notion of getting stuff done, accomplished, putting runs on the board, I'm proud of what we've done. Again, working with the legislature in almost every case, and that's a contrast to Washington. I think the president has done an enormous amount, but he's been blocked from doing the full potential of what we could be doing right now, and that's frustrating.
So you've started a new nonprofit and a political action committee to raise money. So what is your vision then? If it's not to run for president, what, in terms of the national politics, what is it you want to do?
It's a two-way street. It's a very good question. So I am the vice chair of each of the Democratic Governors Association, which is partisan, and the National Governors Association, which is nonpartisan, and I will be, assuming I don't spill my soup on somebody, I will hopefully become chair of each of those organizations over the course of the next year. There's an enormous amount. There's a two-way street for us to transmit what we think we've done well in Jersey and get into the bloodstream nationally. And likewise, we're shameless at ripping off good ideas and promoting them back into New Jersey. So whether it's in a more of a pure political sense, finding allies in the fight who we feel good about standing beside or vice versa, or taking a great policy idea and either exporting it or importing it and promoting it from elsewhere. That's what that's about, basically getting more deeply embedded in the bloodstream. And I think New Jersey at long last being, God willing, right in the center of that mix where all that policy and good politics comes together.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We got folks who are dying to ask you questions. Okay. Dylan from Little Ferry is on the line.
Hey, Dylan.
Hey, Governor Murphy.
How you doing?
I would like to ask about nuclear power as a stopgap for global warming, as, you know, other renewables don't really cover the energy crisis as well as nuclear. So will you be able to bring projects to New Jersey?
Dylan, I think I'd be lying if I said that there was a lot of momentum around bringing new projects to New Jersey. That's not to say it couldn't happen, and the technology has become quite sophisticated, particularly as it relates to these mini reactors. But I'm not sure the market will bear that, honestly. But I can say with conviction, assuming the economics continue to work, we're going to see the existing nuclear power plants, God willing, safely at every step of the way, most importantly, but play out until their expiry dates. And that is a huge deal because that gets us into the thick of the sort of 2035 to 2040 period when a lot of our offshore wind is coming on, a lot of our other alternatives, solar and other, are coming on, and we have a very different configuration of our power, say 15 years from now than we do today, and we've committed to that 100% clean New Jersey by the year 2050, the nukes are a hugely important bridge. Would I never say never to considering one of these highly sophisticated, high-tech, smaller reactors? No, I wouldn't, but I don't think there's a lot of momentum, honestly, around that at the moment, at least.
There is a lot of momentum on wind power, and you and I have talked about it many times, but probably most folks haven't been really following along. So why don't you update us, because you've got this big project in South Jersey to build turbines and a terminal that you're hoping is going to serve the entire East Coast. So where do things stand with that?
Yeah, you said it well. So we've got very big ambitions, 7,500 megawatts of ultimately of offshore wind. That's enough to power 1.5 million to 2 million homes. So that's a big, big deal. It is overwhelming, and it's in process. So this is happening. It's overwhelming a South Jersey phenomenon, and that's exactly where our state economy needs a jolt. You rightfully point out we're building two massive ports in South Jersey, in Salem County, in Paulsboro, the Salem Nuclear Plant, pardon me, in Alloways Creek, and then in Paulsboro. And what's more, we are going to get a lot of the food chain, the manufacturing components of this industry made in New Jersey. So we have a complete commitment to not just get the clean energy, good union jobs, get it installed, but to make the stuff and transit the stuff in New Jersey. It's a game changer for us over the next, particularly in South Jersey, over the next 10 or 15 years.
Right. And New Jersey has a sort of a shallow shelf, which makes it perfect for wind.
You're showing your geological side here.
Is it true that the whole Northeast has that shelf?
Yeah. I don't know the whole Northeast, but we certainly have it. And we are 140-something mile shore. We're sort of the bow of the ship. And you're absolutely right. It falls off, but the shelf comes in. Unlike California, where it's down in a vertical line, you have to actually have floating windmill technology, which is really hard, really expensive. You don't need that in the Jersey side.
Right. Okay. And then what's going on with EV, electric vehicle charging stations?
Yep.
I saw a headline. I can't say I really boned up on this, but I saw a headline a few weeks ago that said that Jersey was like one of the last states in terms of being ready with charging stations.
Yeah, so we're putting a ton of energy and investment and infrastructure into that. And by the way, I just had yet another budget review this morning, so that's something you're always looking at. I think when we got into office, Nancy, folks should have in the back of their mind, we have the 11th largest state population-wise. We had, I believe this is right, when we first got here, the 7th or 9th most electric vehicles, and we were 49th in charging infrastructure.
Right.
And I said, well, we got to shrink that. And it can't be that we go from 7 down to – and so we're throwing an enormous amount through a whole variety of programs, including with the feds, our Department of Transportation, our budget. We are amping up, no pun intended, on both incenting folks to buy more electric vehicles, but more importantly, to your point, putting a lot more – charging infrastructure in the state.
Right, which is critical, of course, because if you're going to buy, you want to know that if you buy an electric car, you can stop and get it charged somewhere along the way.
Absolutely. So, and people don't think probably as often as they should about, I forget what the term of art is, but common living areas, condominium complexes, or obviously rest areas on the parkway and turnpike and other areas where you just are smart, not just somebody who steps up and pays for something at their home, but where it can be a common good, and that's where we're putting a lot of our emphasis.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We have Christopher. I'm looking from Englewood. You're on the line with the governor, Christopher.
Hey, Christopher.
Good evening, Governor. And let me first take a moment to thank you for your leadership during this COVID-19 crisis, even putting your own health at risk, and it meant a lot to us. Regarding the mask mandate in our schools ending on the 7th of March, I am wondering if this mask mandate also includes the colleges in our state, and if not, do you have a timetable as to when you will lift the mandate for the colleges with the masks at this time?
Christopher, thank you for your good words, first of all. Secondly, we made the decision on February, announced the decision on February 7th. We'd lift masks in our public schools. We think we can do that responsibly. This is a good chance to say the numbers continue, Nancy, to go really well in our direction. Each day is better than the day before, and that's been the case probably now for 6 weeks. And by the way, if a district based on their local health reality feels like they can't take that step, that's okay. So they can do that. Or if you or I want to walk into school with a mask on, nobody can bully us or stigmatize us. I'm not sure that we've actually ever spoken explicitly to higher education on this. It's possible, Christopher, we have. I have assumed that that step would be taken the same day, but I want to come back. We're going to come back to Christopher to make sure and confirm that. But I think we're getting into a wholly different place, Nancy. This is transitioning, as we have desperately hoped, from pandemic to endemic, meaning it is beginning to look a lot more like still a severe flu season, but the flu. In other words, you get your booster, you can live a normal life and live with this thing responsibly in your midst.
And is that because the data is showing that it is not as deadly a virus as it was 2 years ago?
It's a combination of a lot of things. Omicron turned out to not be nearly as deadly. However, unfortunately, unless you were unvaccinated or unboosted, in which case people are still dying, sadly.
Yeah.
So it's not as though it's the common cold. So I don't want to go too far here. So that's part of it. But it's the rate of transmission, number of cases, hospitalizations, positivity rate, the fact that we have vaccines that we know are safe and effective, that we know. Remember the debates we used to have in the spring of 2020 about whether or not it was smart to wear masks? It's kind of crazy that we think about that we were having those debates. Experts were having those debates. Mm-hmm. We know masks. I mean, we know the weapons that work here. You combine better weather, not tomorrow or tomorrow night, but better weather in the spring, that all of more, which is better ventilation, all that together, we're in a far better place.
Okay, before we go to a quick break, let's go to Tennyson Donyer of WHYY and also Statehouse reporter for HYY and WBGO. Tennyson is looking at social media and coming up with those questions. What do you have for us?
Hey, Tennyson. Tennyson's on
we
mute.
We do not have any audio from Tennyson.
Hello, Governor. How's it going?
There you go. Me? Good to see you, man.
So Sharif from South Brunswick wants to know if you have plans to forgive some or all of New Jersey student loans for college students.
Well, that's a nice question.
I mean, we do. We have some. The feds are obviously active on that front. We have some pilot programs. We are focused much more on making college more affordable at the front end, including free. Through our community college opportunity grant and our Garden State guarantee. So if you're under a certain income level and you've exhausted all your other sources like Pell Grants, this is intended to be a last dollar you can go for free under a certain adjusted gross income. Very proud that Rutgers is now piggybacking on that. They came up with the Scarlet Guarantee on Monday. Our community college opportunity grant is 2 years. The Garden State Guarantee from us is years 3 and 4 if you've come from the community college, if you've transferred. Theirs is the same notion at Rutgers, New Brunswick, for all 4 years, which is a huge deal. Mm-hmm. So we've had some pilots, some focus on loan forgiveness. I know there's a lot of federal programs. We're much more focused on – because the research shows you're much more likely to actually get to the institution of higher education if you don't have to go through that – oh, my God, I got to hock myself and then worry about paying that off forever. So, we're open-minded to good ideas on both ends. Accessibility and affordability in higher ed is the name of the game for us.
Of course, those programs that you're talking about don't really address students who either have gone to school outside of the state or have went to school 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and are still really struggling with student debt. So any thoughts on
yeah.
that?
So it does not cover the out-of-state crowd, for sure.
Right.
That's right. It does cover somebody. I'll tell you who it does cover. We think of a community college as the old stale model of a bunch of 18 to 21 or 19-year-olds running around. This is all walks of life, all ages of life. And what it does influence, the research has shown and the real life experience has shown that, hey, I would have taken 6 years to do this because I had to get a second or third job to be able to afford it. But because this program exists, I'm actually going to be able to get out of here in 2 years and much more quickly get a career going, earn the money, and maybe therefore more easily make up for the debt that I had incurred in those years until this program came along.
And are we going to – is there any additional money on this that's going into the budget that you're working on right now?
I don't want to make any news, but you should assume programs like this are things that we're committed to. We want to see them expanded. So I'll leave it at that.
So more affordable college for kids who are staying in New Jersey to go to community college or Rutgers.
Or 4 years and not just kids.
Okay, we're going to leave it there and take a quick break, and we'll take more of your calls. I'm Nancy Solomon, and you're listening to Ask Governor Murphy.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University welcomes Broadway and TV star Christopher Jackson as part of the President's Speaker Series on Saturday, March 19th at 8 p.m. Jackson shares his journey from a small town in Illinois to performing as George Washington in Broadway's Hamilton, the lessons he learned, and the mentors and moments that made a difference. For information, it's WCUPATIX.com. That's WCUPATIX.com.
If you grew up in the early aughts, pop punk was one of the defining sounds and styles of the early millennium. My Chemical Romance helped to move a lot of mascara. Avril Lavigne had her own skater boy style. But 20 years later, pop punk is back and looking a little different. This month's Record Club finds out why. That's next time on 1A. Weeknights at 9 on WHYY.
You're listening to Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO News production in collaboration with WNYC and WHYY. Got a question for the governor? Call us at 973-297-0941. That's 973-297-0941. Or pose your question on Twitter or Facebook with the hashtag AskGovMurphy.
I'm Nancy Solomon. We're live with Governor Phil Murphy at WBGO in Newark. And let's go right back to the phones. We have Kevin from Newark. He has a question for the governor.
Hey, Kevin.
Good evening, Governor. How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good. Hanging in there. Just want to echo the last caller. Thank you for your leadership during this pandemic and this trying time. So I really do appreciate it. You've inspired many fellow Newarkers to also, you know, to be involved in their political matters. So here's my question.
Yep.
So regarding tax expenditures, will there be more transparency regarding that? So, for example, a friend of mine lives in Riverhead, Long Island, and whenever she pays her property tax bills, the town mails her a breakdown of her property tax, listing the specific percentages as to where her dollars are going. Do you think that's something New Jersey could consider or possibly do in the future?
Yeah, Kevin, a couple of things. First, thanks for your good words. And in so many respects, we're in Newark. As Newark goes, so goes New Jersey. So, and you're living it. So, number one. Number two, we have that. It depends on the town you live in, I suppose. I suspect, knowing where you live, Nancy, you've got it.
I live in Maplewood, and it's broken down by what is going to the school district and what's going to the county.
Yeah.
But not like in any real detail.
It's not in graphic detail. I'm similar in Middletown. I know it's too much. That's the one thing I know. But broadly speaking, where the buckets are. Could we do more? Yeah, that's something I think the more we're big transparency folks, so that's certainly something I'd be open to. I would say the big thing on property tax, and I'm not going to make news on the budget tonight because we're still pulling it together. We've made progress, but I will tell you something. We are obsessed with making more progress on affordability more broadly and on property taxes more specifically. So I'll leave it at that.
You know, I want to go back. Thanks for your call, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
And I want to just go back to a conversation we're having at the top of the show about your two national facing organizations, the nonprofit and the Political Action Committee, which can raise money. I just wanted to follow up because I didn't get a chance to ask you. So Matt Friedman, a reporter at Politico, has been trying to get you to disclose the donors to your PAC.
He's got a ticker on his
yes, he
thing
does.
Every day.
And you just mentioned transparency, which was it's your fault. It's bringing
my
me
fault.
Back to it. What is your going to be your position on disclosing donors? And, you haven't done it yet, so why not? And are you going to?
Matt, by the way, showed up at an event. I wasn't expecting to see him, but he asked me the question. I said, I think I'm going to hold off on that, but it's good to see you. And he said, what do you mean good to see you? And I said, I actually meant it was good to see you. I still don't think he believes me. Listen, that organization, Stronger, Fairer, Forward, a 501c4, which is going to be the executive director is Dan Bryan, who's 8 feet to my left, is going to make some determination on that front. And I'll leave that to Dan for the news to make. And we'll leave it at that.
So but you're not going to say whether
It's Dan's call, not mine.
Okay. I guess I'll have to leave that one. So we've got more calls coming in. We have Joy from Morris County on the line. Joy?
Hey, Joy.
Yes, good evening.
Good
thank
evening, Joy.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. And thank you, Governor, for all your good work you've done with the pandemic.
Thank you, Joy.
I have a question about the legalization of cannabis for homegrown use, as they have now in New York State. They're permitting any individual who wants to grow cannabis. Now, this is not for smoking, but for culinary purposes, for nutritional purposes, to include in their diet and dietary use, which is not being considered anywhere by you. But New York State is permitting individuals to grow up to 12 plants, and I would appreciate if you would likewise do the same for New Jersey.
Okay. Joy, good to hear from you. And thanks for your good words. I've never been heck no against that. It so happens the legislation, and it was a hard-fought battle. You'll remember we talked a lot about whether or not it could pass legislatively. It turned out it was a referendum, and then you had to actually put a law together, and that was a challenge. And none of this is easy. We're doing it for social justice, and darn it, we're going to get this right, but it's not easy. But I've never been heck no on that, and so that's something that I haven't spoken to the legislative leadership about that, but that's something I'd be open-minded to.
Does that have to go to the legislature, or is that something the Cannabis Regulatory Commission could decide?
I'm virtually certain that has to go to the legislature. Uh-huh. If that's not right, we're going to find a way to correct the record.
Is there any argument against it?
I'm sure there is, but I'm not.
I mean, I can imagine the cannabis growers don't want it,
but that's
not really an argument.
Yeah, although that implies, and that's a good point. That implies that these are big corporate behemoths, and I'm sure there's going to be some of that. But we are really obsessed with equity in every respect, including undoing the wrongs of the past from the war on drugs, particularly in Black and Brown communities. But also prospectively, who gets the licenses, who gets to operate these things, who gets to earn a profit from it. And that includes some pretty – which is why this has been hard to get this industry stood up – some pretty cool programs that allow the mom and pops of the world to get into this at the front end and not get crowded out by the big players. So it isn't just the little guy at home, if you will, or in Joy's case at home versus – a big corporate, there's also a desire to get the mom and pops and a diverse array of license holders in this from the get-go.
So I'll take this opportunity to ask my monthly question. What's taking so long?
You
know, we're past the deadline now. Everyone's waiting for the cannabis stores to open.
Yeah. So it turns out the deadline was the no earlier than date. So I think even I gave people the impression that it was the end of the line as opposed to the no earlier than date. I think if I had to predict, I've said this before, but I mean this literally in this case. I think we're within weeks. I would hope in March that you're going to see explicit movement on the medical dispensary, some number of them being able to sell recreational. And you and I have talked about this. They've got to prove that they've got to get all the local approvals, but they've got to prove that they've got the supply for their medical customers first and foremost. And then I hope shortly thereafter, the standalone retail adult use cannabis operations. Again, equity is incredibly important to us. I think that is not only important, but it makes it more complicated to get off the ground. But I think it will have been worth it, assuming we get this right.
Has anything about this surprised you? Has it been more difficult than you expected?
There's no question. And that includes and the commission. Diana Huenu is a rock star. The team around her, the professional team, that's not – I don't mean that in the narrow sense. When you look at polling on adult use, even from the earliest days of our administration, you would assume – that you could get a legislative fix. And you and I talked about this. There were very few states that did this legislatively. Most of the states ultimately did it through a referendum, which we ultimately did it through. But I was convinced, and I think at the time Steve Sweeney was convinced, and others, Nick Scutari, who's now the Senate president, that you could get the votes. And we we all tried hard to get that done, Speaker Coughlin. Turns out there was largely generational, but it was just something we couldn't break through. And then when you go to the referendum route, there's a certain amount of time you have to have on the clock. So that added another piece to it. And by the way, sure enough, when you put it to referendum, it passed with an overwhelming majority. Then you have to go back and you have to do the underpinning legislation, and that was really complicated. And then we all got that done, and we were at the table, so we were the part of this. Then we had to tweak some stuff. We didn't get that right. And then you had to set the commission, get the commissioners, get the professional staff. So the whole thing, not for any one reason, not for any one person's actions, this thing has taken longer. But I'm in the category: better to be right than fast. And God willing, that's what we'll get. We're going to get an industry which is defined by equity. And while we didn't do it for the jobs or the economic benefit, there's no question this is an industry that's going to have a significant presence in New Jersey.
Okay. Well, I'll be asking again in March, our next show.
We better darn well make progress by March.
Okay. Well, let's go back to questions that we get coming in on social. We have Tennyson Donier, the State House reporter for WHYY and WBGO with us. Tennyson, what do you have?
All right. So California recently discussed a single-payer health care bill. It would have been the first state to enact that. That bill was not successful, but Patricia from Northfield would like to know if that's something you would consider for New Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, is it Patricia?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'd say to Patricia and Tennyson, by the way, good to see you, by the way, on the screen. Would I consider it? Absolutely. It is a showstopper in terms of expense and the budget impact. I'm not going to hang my hat on this, but I believe in California it was $40 billion.
Wow.
It's a big lift. So I'd consider it. It's like a lot of things. If it were done at the federal level, where you can print money, and way back when the Affordable Care Act was coming together, that was ultimately taken off the table, as you'll recall. It was part of it. In the interim, I am really proud of a lot of the stuff that we've done, including, most importantly, building our own healthcare exchange and taking big chunks of the premium that folks pay and drive it directly into allowing more folks to access and afford healthcare where they couldn't before. Either they couldn't at all before, or they could at great expense to them, and now they can do it much more reasonably. That's progress that we've made. NJ.getcovered.gov had a huge year of getting more folks coming on. Unless we can find a reason, open-minded to it conceptually, a single payer, but unless we can find the resources, we're going to continue to chip at and shrink the number of folks who don't have health care, God willing, by the day.
Well, and this is a good segue for one of the questions I have for you, which is you talked in your State of the State speech and in your inaugural speech, both in January, about one of your priorities for your second term would be getting healthcare costs down.
Yep.
And so healthcare costs for government down, like for teachers and firefighters, yep, which then brings down taxes, one would hope. But also making health care is such a big part of everyone's budget. It's so expensive.
Yep.
So tell us a little about that, like what you're thinking about.
So great point. So we talked about three areas of affordability. I'll only touch health care in the interest of time. Health care, higher education, property taxes. So there's a lot going on in all those. You're absolutely right. In our first term on health care, we not only built the exchange that I talked about, which is broad-based. That's not specific to state employees or educators. That's impacting man on the street lives outside of those professions. We have been able to do – I'm proud of this. That we achieved the holy grail with state employees in the sense that we were able to wring out savings, not impact the quality of health care, and save taxpayers money. That folks said you couldn't do that, and I'm proud that we did. But the point you're making is what more can you do at the kitchen table? And the point I made was this that day. You try to budget in your family, and you look – by the way, I'm putting the crazy energy prices aside for the moment. And we've got inflation in a big way right now. So I'm going to take us to what we hope will be sooner than later, a more normal time. Milk's going up this, bread's going up that, school books are going up this. In a normal time, you could probably have some handle on gas, et cetera. The one area in America, and certainly in New Jersey, where if you're trying to look out a year, try to predict prescription drug costs, healthcare as a general matter, is the one thing that has been lurching well beyond anything else you're trying to budget at your kitchen table. So we said, you know what, enough already. We got all the stakeholders at the table and said, we're going to, first of all, deliver transparency so folks know exactly what's behind the price of that prescription drug that you're paying. What are the components of that? What's the insurer get? What's the pharmaceutical get? What's the pharmaceutical benefit manager, the PBM, the healthcare provider, the system? And secondly, we're going to get a commitment from everybody that we're going to, over the next 5 years, we're going to get our arms around healthcare costs. I just announced a couple of bills with our legislative colleagues in this arena a week or two ago. So it's an area where we said, you know what, enough already. It can't be. It is the outlier. And I'm leaving energy aside, particularly given energy driven by a potential global war, God forbid. But in a normal sort of world, healthcare is the outlier. We cannot allow that to continue.
And how do you, as the governor of the state, then get that done with private? I mean, you can't tell doctors not to charge too much money, or So how do you interface with the private marketplace to get that done?
Well, you pass laws, and so we proposed a couple of laws, and they were directed in particular at the pharmacy benefit managers. The one thing you have to accept, it's an unusual industry in the pharmaceutical slice of this, because you've got enormous research and development expenditures and timelines that can go on for decades, and you get one out of 20 that hit. So there's some amount of you have to appreciate that this is not a loaf of bread. This is a complex product. But you've got to get a commitment from folks that you literally – and maybe it's statutorily, maybe it's through executive action, maybe it's through collective action that you get all the players together and say, you know what, we're committed, either because we have to by law or because we're agreeing to by collective action, we're going to agree to a reasonable future here in terms of healthcare costs.
And have you had conversations with legislative leaders? Are they
absolutely?
They're on board with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I was with Troy Singleton and John McKeon in Willingboro 10 days ago. And listen, we're starting. We're not doing everything yet because we want to make sure we get this right. And we want to make sure everybody understands that food chain. There's not just one party here that contributes to the inflation in healthcare that we've seen over the past decades. It's a combination. It's a buildup of, as I mentioned, all the players in that food chain. We want to make sure folks, we believe, I think this is probably more broadly believed, the more you know, the better informed a decision you can make. And almost always when you have more transparency, it leads to more affordability.
And, you mentioned, and you and I together mentioned it, this just in this hour, inflation is a huge issue right now for so many, for all of us.
Yep.
Anything that you can do as governor to step in right now and do something to affect it, or is this just not something that a governor can do?
No, sure. I'll take a shot at my party. I think we were in the camp that we were late to this, and we were way in the transitory, not going to be around for long. It's going to be around for this year, let's put it that way. But no, we're putting our budget together, and there's a lot we're looking at. Maybe not directly, the biggest source of inflation is energy prices up because Russia's about to invade Ukraine. We'll look at things we can do around that. I'm a fan of a notion at the federal level of having a gas tax holiday. I like that. That's much more easily done at the federal level than at the state level. But we're looking at a lot of other elements that we can press a button, even holidays, Nancy, and say for the balance of this year, you won't have to pay this. Things like that
a long list we're looking at.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there, and we will be back in a minute. You're listening to Ask Governor Murphy. I'm Nancy Solomon.
Tonight in Radio Times, the crisis in Ukraine and why it matters. We'll talk about Russia's aggression, the response from NATO and the U.S. as Kiev prepares for war. That's Radio Times tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. Philadelphia is one of the highest vaccinated cities in the country, and you can keep your immune system strong this year by getting boosted. Philly.gov/vaccine or 311.
On the next Fresh Air, Quinta Brunson, the creator and star of the new hit ABC sitcom Abbott Elementary, about the teachers in a majority black, under-resourced elementary school in Philadelphia. Her mother taught in such a school. Brunson got her start as a stand-up comic and the creator of short comic online videos. Join us.
Tonight at 8 o'clock on WHYY.
You're listening to Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO News production in collaboration with WHYY and WNYC. Got a question for the governor? Call us at 973-297-0941. That's 973-297-0941. Or pose your question on Twitter or Facebook with the hashtag AskGovMurphy.
I'm Nancy Solomon. We're live in Newark with Governor Phil Murphy, and we're taking your calls. So let us know what questions you have for the governor. We have Patrick on the line from Clifton. Good evening, Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
Good evening. Good evening, Governor.
Good evening.
Governor, I just want to mention before I start, I was up at a place called Murph's in Totowa, and I commented on your green and white pants.
I love that.
When I told my mother that, she said, how rude you are. The next time you see him, you apologize.
No.
So I apologize for my comment on where did you get those from?
No, do not apologize. And please give Murph a hug for me next time you see him.
All right. What I'm calling about is motor vehicles. And I cannot tell you how frustrated it is to – they send us up to an office off of 287 – there's a line there. There's a police officer with a gun. They let you go in one at a time. I'm trying to help a friend of mine who speaks Spanish. He goes in. They say you have to come back. He waited for that appointment 6 weeks. And every time he goes up again, they say you have to come back because you don't have an appointment. Do you have somebody who a human being that we could talk to?
Sure.
It's really horrible.
Yeah. Listen, that's unacceptable. I'll ask Sue Fulton, who's the administrator, or one of her senior people, Patrick, to reach out to you, and maybe more importantly, to your friend.
Yes.
You know, we've said this many times here. They got hit with a tsunami. They had to close. When they reopened, they needed to make sure they did it in a safe, responsible health way. They were able to convert a lot of transactions online. They're now doing many more transactions per week than they did before the pandemic because they're doing a lot of them online. But listen, if that's the experience and there's frustration and it's a lived experience, you just didn't hear about this, you were there, that's on us. We have to meet that moment. Now, the good news is, as I mentioned earlier, this is getting better, the pandemic, that is, and we're going to have a lot more degrees of freedom in terms of being with each other, more open, more in person. Again, I don't want to – I was asked this question today, Nancy, would you envision you'd now go from all the good online stuff you've done back to in person? I said I wouldn't do that if I thought the online move was a better experience. In other words, we don't want this – I love the Model T, but I'd like to go back to my horse and buggy. If we think we've got a better fix, we want to stay with that. But if the current situation, either online or in person, is – significantly worse than the pre-pandemic or is worse period than the pre-pandemic experience, it's on us to get that fixed as fast as we can. Again, I have a lot of sympathy with the workforce, the leadership. This has been really hard, but you can't hear stories like that and not say, you know what, you got to do something here.
Well, and I have to admit, I have a a dog in this fight because my daughter has not been able to get her learner's permit for over a year. And
Come
it's
on.
Been super frustrating. And what's frustrating is that I, you know, there were long lines, and so everything moved to appointments.
Yeah.
And then it's so hard to get an appointment. So you don't, you know, there's no, the lines have kind of been driven underground and unseeable because you have to get it, you're at home alone trying to get an appointment online. So
may I say the same thing to you that I would say to a caller? Can we get her details seriously?
She would love that.
Dan Bryan is going to get her details.
But that might not be fair. But, you know, it's I think, you know, this is something that governors live and die by, right? It's these kind of state services that are so critical.
And by the way, before 2 years ago, we had incredibly creative conversations about motor vehicles, unemployment insurance benefits. These folks have had to put up with a tsunami. I have to say that. They've done heroic work. That's not – listen, over here, you're frustrated. I don't blame you. I'm not making any excuses. We're not going to rest until we fix it. And I know the leadership of both those organizations. But they have done an enormous amount in those 2 years. But we got to bat 1,000. Deb Cuernavaca has just volunteered to take – is it your niece or daughter?
It's my daughter.
Your daughter. And Deb's going to personally take that one.
I mean, I think that it's – I think what I'd like to see is that they go back to more in-person services where you can just walk in and wait in line.
Yeah. But again,
you know, I mean, the online stuff is great, but I think both need to happen.
That was my point. Some of the online stuff, we're never going back because it's a huge improvement and they deserve a lot of credit for that. And that's why they're doing a lot more volume. But there's some stuff that you need. And by the way, even if it isn't a faster fix, there's some comfort, right? So I get this on unemployment all the time. Can you get the one stops back up? And my answer is we're going to do that. And I hope in the next number of weeks. But don't have your expectation be that because I'm looking at Nancy, that my situation will get done faster. If it's a complicated situation, it may not, but we understand that.
Okay, don't answer any and say anything more about unemployment because I believe we have a question coming to you. We have Michael from Jackson on the line. Michael, good evening.
Hey, Michael.
Good evening, Governor. Great to speak with you. I'm a big fan.
Thank you, sir.
However, it's not to say that I don't have an issue that I'm hoping you can help resolve. I worked with New Jersey Transit for 8 years, and I was laid off furloughed in 2020.
Okay.
Got my unemployment benefits and carried on, went back to work. I'm working again now. But in 2021, something similar happened for 10 weeks, and it's been now over a year that I haven't been able to receive any benefits. Huh. I had a little more help with getting through on the phone. But there always seems to be a goalpost move or new hoops to jump through.
Oh, God.
And I was hoping, I think I'm the same person, the same address, doing the same job, in the same situation was a year ago. I was hoping if I could just speak with someone in person that it might be able to resolve the issue. Any idea on when we might have the state offices open that might be able to do so?
Yeah, the state offices are opening. That's not the challenge, but I'll get someone to call you tomorrow. How's that? It'll be either the commissioner himself or one of his senior folks. Nancy's heard me say this so many times, so I feel badly saying it again, but it is a fact. It's hard to make a blanket. Early on in the pandemic, there were some blanket statements you could make. The system crashed over the weekend. Everybody was in the same boat. There was an upgrade to some federal element. And by the way, the federal technology and underpinning infrastructure is where the big challenge is here. We can only do so much, although in our budget, as I mentioned, we're putting it together. We're looking at what we can do in the budget this year in New Jersey that's even more so. But it's almost always, Michael, a very specific situation that's highly unique to the person. So I don't want to – first of all, I feel awful that you're frustrated. Thank you for your service to NJ Transit. Thanks for your good words about me. But I'm going to get Rob or one of his senior guys to call you. Rob, by the way, is a Rutgers grad. They're down 2 to Michigan at half, by the way, in the men's basketball game. I want to make sure you got that.
Okay, thank you. Let's say WBGO and WHYY State House reporter who's looking at questions that are coming in. Tennyson, what do you have for us?
All right. So my next question is actually a report today that we put out on reparations. And Governor Murphy, you did get back to me about that, about the wealth. This seems to be an issue that Black leaders have brought to the forefront for the last few years. I've really been pushing for a reparations task force to study the effects of slavery and systemic oppression here in New Jersey. I'm wondering why this hasn't really caught on, if this is something that why it's challenging for this to get moved.
It's a great tennis. Is this coming from you, or was this somebody else?
This is coming from me, actually.
This is from you.
Sorry.
So this is an important one. And so we just had a big meeting. Dan, was it yesterday? Yesterday, literally on this. So we put together, and I announced it last Juneteenth, a wealth disparity task force. And it's populated with incredible talent. And the wealth disparities, I think it's worth taking a second if we have a second here, Nance.
Yeah.
The wealth disparities in this state are jaw-dropping. And Tennyson, you may have the exact numbers, but it is something like this. The average African-American family's net worth is $6,500, $6,800. A Latino family is maybe another $1,000, $7,500. An average white family last year, I think $245,000. Dollars. And so the Wealth Disparity Task Force is its remit. What the heck? How did we get here? And what are we going to do about it? Now, again, we're the stronger, fairer administration. So from the get-go, we've been disproportionately investing in correcting and curing inequities. So we're on a journey already. But the question is, what more? Those numbers are jaw-dropping. What more do you need to do? And if you look at Black and brown communities and how we got to those awful disparities, this is back to Tennyson's question, you get there some similar reasons, but some very different reasons. And slavery is the big one that jumps out at you. And so the question is, there's a separate bill, I'm not sure what its status is in the legislature, which is specific to the reparation piece, the slavery piece explicitly within that overall wealth disparity. You know, what's the history? New Jersey's history is pretty awful. Last state to ratify the 13th Amendment, a very significant slave trade among the weak players of the northern states, at least. Acknowledging that, trying to quantify, and then what do you do about it? What's the federal government do? What can we do? I do know this, that addressing and investing aggressively in curing inequities, whether it's a wealth disparity task force or you're discussing the damages of slavery and reparations specifically, I know that aggressive investing and addressing those and curing those inequities has been and will continue to be part of our mindset. But we literally talk about this all the time. I can't speak for the legislation as to why that is where it is. But I do know that we are full speed ahead in the Wealth Disparity Task Force.
And if the legislature were to pass a reparations bill, you would sign it?
I never comment on something like that because I don't know what it looks like. So, but the notion of trying to get our arms around this is something that we are not just conceptually good with, but we're proving it with this Wealth Disparity Task Force. The Wealth Disparity Task Force casts an even broader net, frankly. So it's a big deal.
Whatever happened to the, and maybe a lot has happened, I just sort of lost track of it, baby bonds. That was something that was brought up, a couple years ago?
A couple of budgets ago.
Yeah.
I still love the idea.
But it's never made it into the actual budget.
Never got out of the legislature. I think...
And maybe we should explain. I'm sorry to interrupt, but so a baby bond, all the children who get born in a certain year get a bond. It's worth a certain amount of money, and then it grows, and the state puts in more money, and it grows over 18 years, and then you get this big nest egg.
You get it at maturity, and it's the best versions of this are means tested. So you're going after the folks, you're going after the kids and the families that need it the most. I still love the idea, punchline. I love the idea, and perhaps that's part of the solution here, it's a much more powerful weapon at the federal level because they can put a lot more firepower into it. Mm-hmm. Senator Booker is the nation's, I think, premier proponent of this at the federal level. His models, just because they had a lot more money, they can print money, that his models had that nest egg a lot bigger than the one you can get out of New Jersey. I'd do both, frankly. But I like the idea, particularly if you're targeting that investment. This can't be a one-size-fits-all program, and it never was intended to be in our case.
And is that going to be in your budget that you present to the legislature for this year, or
no,
that's now off the table?
No, I wouldn't say it's off the table. No, I'm not going to make any budget news, but I would just say that it's something that we are – I like that. I like it a lot. But I want to make sure also that if we do it, it gets done, and it gets done with a heft that will make a difference in these kids' lives.
Okay, let's try to squeeze in another call. We have Will from New Brunswick on the line. Will?
Hey, Will.
Hi, can you hear me?
You bet.
Yep, we got you.
Okay, great. Good evening, Governor Murphy.
Hey,
I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Just recently, we noticed that Governor Hochul in New York passed something called the SLEEP Act.
Sleep.
Which has to do with reducing motor vehicle noise, you know, from modified exhaust in cars and motorcycles and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Well, I'm a long-term resident of New Brunswick, been here for years, and in recent years, things have just gotten incredibly loud because, you know, we live in the city and near busy streets, and the number of vehicles which are running around with modified exhausts or extremely loud radios, whatever, but violating noise, you know, violating people's quality of life has really become extreme. And It was just really great to see New York take the bull by the horns and pass that. And a lot of municipalities, I guess, are installing what are called noise cameras.
Will, we're almost out of time. I assume your question is, would the governor do something about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
so take a look at this.
Yeah. Will, thanks for your good words, and I love New Brunswick. Yeah, it's something. I'm going to ask Sean LaTourette, who's our commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection, to follow up. Conceptually, I like it. I have to say I'm not that familiar with it, but we have this issue. But I've got an office in Newark and in Trenton. In Trenton, behind me is a parking lot and a nice green hill. In Newark, we're right over in Gateway. And what Will's talking about is a fact. I mean, this is – and it's getting louder and not softer. So the answer is conceptually, I'd love to look at something like that.
I guess one way of doing it is just having, cars wouldn't pass inspection if they're too noisy, if they're loud or something like that.
I would think, although I have to admit I don't know the details of that particular bill. By the way, Governor Hochul, I think, is off to a terrific start.
But you're having a fight with her over the Waterfront Commission, so we got 1 minute left. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I would say less with her. She and I had a very good discussion about it. We certainly see this differently. But a couple of things here. The Waterfront Commission, if folks don't know it, oversees the ports of New Jersey and New York.
I'm afraid you get 30 seconds.
I get 30 seconds.
Yeah.
We have 90% of the business, and it's an incredibly ineffective organization. We want out, and we're going to get out at the end of March. We've had it. But I've got a very, very good relationship with Governor Hochul. Waterfront Commission and me, not so much. Governor Hochul, I'm a big fan of.
Well, but give me 10 seconds on why you want out of the Waterfront
Commission. We have 90% of the business, and they dictate the terms. And secondly, they won't approve our hirings. We're 600-700 people behind in hiring. Unacceptable.
The show is produced by Doug Doyle and Joseph Cabriglione with help from David Antoine and Tennyson Donier. And our engineer is Corey Goldberg. I'm Nancy Solomon. Thanks so much for listening. This is Ask Governor Murphy.
WHYY is supported by BioNTech and Pfizer.
WHYY monitors traffic and transit for major delays. Supported by the Ad Council.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM Atlantic City, WNJZ-FM Cape May Courthouse, WNJM-FM Manahawkin, WNJB-FM Bridgeton, and WNJS-FM Berlin.
Coming up on 8 o'clock, I'm Kenneth Burns from the New Jersey Desk, thanking you for listening to Ask Governor Murphy. Fresh Air is next on WHYY. The world returns tomorrow.